Well, the Lord be with you. Amen. Today is the 12th and final day of Christmas, but there are no drummers drumming. There's no baby in the manger, no angels or shepherds, no wise men from the east, nor crazy kings after the Messiah. In fact, Mary and Joseph are nowhere to be found in our reading this morning. This opening prologue to John's Gospel could hardly be considered a birth story. It's sort of one part poem, one part philosophical treatise. It's full of images and word plays and big, heady concepts. It's quite possible that it was an early hymn of the church. People couldn't read, so songs helped them to remember. But there's another feature to this prologue. It functions the way that prologues did in ancient Greek dramas. At the beginning of a play, a narrator would often read a prologue that would set the mythological background that would help you understand the events that would unfold throughout a play. This seems to be precisely what John is doing in the opening words of his gospel. He begins the prologue in this way, "In the beginning." We know those words, don't we? Those are the first words of the Bible. And this is intentional. This is John's way of pulling us back to that old story and saying, what you're about to read is the continuation of the story recorded by the people of Israel. And then he continues. In the beginning was the Word. The Word in that story of Israel in Genesis. It was the voice of God. Remember, nothing existed. There was darkness and there was God until God spoke the Word. The Hebrew words, ye'or, let there be light. And boom, light came forth. John is telling his audience that this Word existed before the universe was formed. And the Word was there along with God. And the Word was God. And here we begin to see the formation of the Christian understanding of the Trinity, of a God that is more than simply one being, but in relation to God's self. And he uses this to set the backdrop for his Jewish audience. But by speaking of the Word, John is also appealing to an entirely different audience, a non-Jewish group. The Greek word that John uses here for Word is logos. Yes, it means Word, but much more than that. Throughout the development of Greek philosophy, the logos played an important role and had many different meanings and explanations. It meant wisdom or the purity of reason. It meant the highest ideal, or it meant the order of the cosmos, the universe. No matter what the philosophical tradition, the logos was one of the big ideas for the Greeks. So when John begins this prologue, framing how to understand the events that will unfold, he casts the net wide, drawing the attention of all seekers of truth, his fellow Jewish insiders, and those seeking wisdom and truth elsewhere. And here are the key things that he foreshadows in this prologue. Three things. First, though with God, though being God, the Word is going to be rejected. Second thing, those who did not reject the Word became children of God. And third, the Word became flesh and dwelled among us, resplendent in glory and full of grace and truth. Three big ideas. And I want to just reflect on those a little bit this morning. The first, the word will be rejected. Now, John's Jewish audience had been waiting for centuries for God to speak a word again. The Greek philosophers developed centuries-old traditions involving this notion of the Logos. So why on earth would the word, the Logos, be rejected? The simple answer is that Jesus did not look like the Messiah the Jewish people were looking for. And the idea that the Logos would become flesh was absurd to the Greeks. In other words, God did not fit inside of their frames, so either their frames had to break or God had to go away. And this is how it is with God. When the Word becomes flesh, it is not in the form of a powerful ruler who asserts divine power or will over others, smiting enemies or infidels. God does not demand worship. No, the Word comes humbly, incognito, in a form that is non-threatening and completely unanticipated. The Word, Christ, accepts rejection, even while desiring, as the Apostle Paul puts it, that all things be reconciled to God through Christ, the Word. So God does not force people to accept the Word, but gives the freedom to say no. And as John foreshadows, many will use that freedom to reject the Word. Second big idea. Those who accept the Word become children of God. More exactly, John says that to those who received Him, He gave power to become children of God. It's another way of saying that God not only comes humbly, but gives power away. It is not power to do what one wants, but power to become children of God. What does that mean? Well, it meant a lot to the people who identified as children of Abraham. This was how God was going to fulfill the promise to bless all the earth through the family of Abraham. To be a part of Abraham's family was to be chosen as part of God's blessing. But now, to be children of God, that is to be part of the blessing in a whole different way. This is a way of John saying that the Word, not Abraham, is the source of that blessing. And this is John's way of saying that the blessing of God extends beyond that family. One of the primary images throughout the New Testament to describe conversion or transformation or salvation is this image of adoption. Adoption is claiming a person as one's own. Out of love and a desire to be with us, God extends the invitation to be adopted as children of God through the Word. This is part of the Christian practice of baptism. Remember when Jesus was baptized, the skies opened and the voice came from the Father in heaven. And what did it say? But this is my Son, whom I love. In our baptisms, we too receive this promise. God claims us as God's own, saying, "This, you are my child, Amanda. You are my child, Jen. Jim, you are my child, whom I love. All of you." This is also why I wear a white robe so often in our worship. The white robe is a simple baptismal robe. It says the pastor who's ordained to word and sacrament is not qualified on the grounds of his or her credentials or education or status, but simply by virtue of their baptism and their calling. This is also why we have a font open to touch the water. It's a simple reminder to you when you touch the water, you are my beloved child. The water symbol symbolizes that you are washed clean in baptism and redeemed in your union with God through Christ. Thanks be to God for that. Third big idea. The Word became flesh and pitched a tent among us. We talked about this last Sunday in the discussion time after worship. This phrase, pitched a tent. It's the literal meaning of what often gets translated dwelt or lived. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. The idea of a tent, once again, goes back to the history of Israel. When God rescued the Israelites from slavery in Egypt and brought them into the wilderness, He gave instructions to build a large tent in which God would live so that God could be with the people, and that tent moved along with them on their journey. Now, John says, the Word has once again pitched a tent among us. But this time it is different. The tent is not made of cloth, but of a human life. And to describe that life, John uses the Greek word sarx. And for those steeped in the thinking of Greek philosophy, this was problematic. For them, things of the spirit, like ideas or the logos, were good and pure. But things of material substance, like this pulpit with its reverberating microphone, and bodies, sarx, these things were impure and corruptible. They don't belong together. We're trying to get away from things like flesh. So for the logos to become sarx was completely appalling. But in Christ, God made a powerful statement that the created world is not bad or impure. There is dignity, purity, and goodness in the physical world, even in human bodies. You will find the Christ transforming, therefore, created stuff into something new and good. Water into good wine. Sickness into health. The demon possessed into free people. Death into life. This five-word phrase, and the Word became flesh, is one of the greatest scandals for the philosophers, and yet it is a great hope. It is God saying yes to stuff, to you, to creation. So these are the three big ideas at the beginning of John's Gospel. And over the next few weeks, we'll get to see how these things play out throughout John's story. So we'll be reading sections of John's Gospel throughout this season of Epiphany. And in particular, those I am statements that Jesus makes. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world, and so on. But for today, the question remains, what do these big ideas matter to us? How do they matter to us? The Word will be rejected. Those who accept the Word are children of God. The Word became flesh and pitched a tent among us. How do these matter for our lives today? You know, I think it's easy to allow things that describe us to become so powerful that they define us. There's a difference between describing and defining. There are many things, important things, no doubt, that describe us, our upbringing, our interests, our political affiliation, our great memories, and our tragic experiences. Our marital, socioeconomic, educational, employment statuses. These things may well be important ways of describing us, but they do not offer the complete definitive story of who you are. In John's prologue, however, we hear what is definitive. What matters more than all these things? You are a child of God, beloved, worthy of dignity and worth in God's eyes. And this dignity and worth is affected in no way by the things that describe us. What greater thing could define who you are, how you see yourself, how you live your life, than the truth that the Word became flesh and pitched a tent so as to be with you? Robert Frost once wrote in a poem, "But God's own descent into flesh was meant as a demonstration that the supreme merit lay in risking spirit in substantiation." I think what he's saying here is that God took the supreme risk, giving up power for presence, giving up the heavenly realm to pitch a tent here with us, giving up logos for sarx. All this so as to woo the beloved creation into a renewed oneness with God. This is why John says that we have received grace upon grace, and I would add upon grace, upon grace, upon grace. It is God showering grace upon all people, and this is the essence of Christmas. And the question for us this morning, will we accept the Word? Will we let this grace and truth truly define our lives? I want to invite you to try something. It's a simple spiritual practice that you can practice anytime. So it might feel a little awkward, but trust me, please. I just want you to repeat the following words out loud. I am God's beloved child, deserving of love and respect, and nothing can take that away. I offer you a challenge. I challenge you to say these words each morning when you wake up. If it helps to look in the mirror and say them, say it. For couples, consider saying these words to each other, to one another. You are God's beloved child, worthy of love and respect, and nothing can change that. This may seem a little hokey, I get it. But imagine what life might look like if the love of God shared with the world at Christmas had the definitive influence on your life. Imagine if who you are, how you see yourself, how you live your life and treat others were formed and transformed by God's love for you. Maybe you'd see shame transformed into dignity. Weakness transformed into strength. Enmity transformed into love. Anxiety transformed into peace. Insecurity transformed into confidence. Not arrogance, but confidence in your belovedness. Friends, know that this grace and this truth are for you. This is God's Christmas gift to the world, to you. May you open it. May you try it on and enjoy it. May you share it with others, because it is a gift that is meant to be shared. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and